From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. With the time difference, the Singapore summit is scheduled to begin at 6 p.m. President Trump and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un are already in Singapore. They're preparing for this meeting that could be historic. We're going to check in with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken. The whole world is talking about this summit.
Oh, I thought the whole world was talking about our program, as they should be. But yes, the whole world is talking about it. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen because you have such unpredictable characters there, President Trump and Kim Jong-un. But you're absolutely right. The whole world is watching.
Well, I'll tell you what. They're all going to be talking about that first minute, which the president set up for himself because he tweeted that he would know, quote, within the first minute, unquote, if the meeting is going to be a success. And
I guess... Well, you know something? I mean, look, the president prides himself in the fact that he does no preparation, doesn't read briefing. He does everything on instinct. In his book, The Art of the Deal, a lot of it was about his gut feeling, his instinct. That's the way he prepared for the presidential campaign. Matter of fact, he did not do any briefings prior to his debates with Hillary Clinton. And whether he won those debates or not, the fact is he's president of the United States. So he thinks it's a winning strategy. It certainly has him on the front page of every newspaper in the country. Between his dissing of Canada and the G7 allies and what may happen in Singapore, the president has the attention he wants. He has the magnifying glass he wants. And that's always been what gets Donald Trump ticking.
Let's call that a fractured ending over the weekend, the G7 meeting. And now this ongoing tension, to say the least, with Canada and its prime minister. So this summit is coming on the heels of that. And I guess with what you just said, you throw all the predictors out because in one sense, maybe the energy of sort of the combat or the dissonance is fuel for this time in Singapore.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely no reason why we need to predict anything anyway, because as we said, the issues are clear. I mean, we have a situation on the Korean Peninsula, a war that ostensibly ended in 1953, but there's no peace treaty. We have American troops in South Korea that North Korea doesn't like. North Korea has nuclear capabilities that the United States and the rest of the world don't like. So obviously there are issues there, but the fact is we have a president of the United States sitting down with the leader, the dictator of North Korea, that something that, you know, didn't happen with Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, any other predecessor as president. So, again, we don't know if there's going to be any kind of deal, any kind of proclamation, anything of substance coming out of it. The fact that they're sitting down and talking could be, look, it could be a Kim propaganda victory. We don't know. But as far as we know right now, it's unpredictable because it's never happened before. And of course, unpredictable is exactly the kind of word that Kim and Trump live by.
Well, the meeting itself is a victory. The fact that the meeting was scheduled and then seemed to fall apart and has been revived and retrieved, put back in place, that too adds to the column of victory here. What, in terms of a specific issue discussion, makes it a success, Ken? Because they're going to be talking about nuclear weapons. They're going to be navigating a conversation of peace between the two countries. So what on the plus side do they walk out of this with if there's going to be a statement to the world that we did it, we achieved something?
Well, I mean, we're going back to what we just said. I think the fact is that they're sitting down together is a victory of something. I think that's a proclamation worth sharing for the world.
Right,
but
there will be that probably joint press conference at the end where we're going to hear from both leaders. And what's the best thing we could hear out of it?
Well, we have an understanding to continue to talking. I mean, obviously, you know, if you think of what the president said about, you know, Justin Trudeau, that, you know, he's very dishonest and weak. And here he is talking to Kim Jong-un, who he's talked about, you know, who he mocked only several months ago. And now he's talking about him as a world leader, which he is. Again, they're not going to say nuclear weapons are leaving the Korean Peninsula. They're not going to say that U.S. troops are leaving South Korea. They're not going to do that. They're certainly not going to do it on the first visit. But again, I think that the world would be very fascinating to watch the fact that the two of them actually met, shook hands, got some kind of reaction out of it, and agreed to agree, or at least agreed to continue this dialogue. Believe me, in the scheme of things, that is a victory.
I think you're right, because the calling of names or using, you know, weak, dishonest, I was betrayed, whatever, we've gotten used to that as being part of how this president does business. And
look, that's
maybe
the way you
we
and I talk to each other on the show. On the show, I understand that, and that's what's so remarkable. The fact is that that kind of vitriol may disappear, at least for the present.
Well, maybe we won't see anything specific in terms of a policy framework or even a specific point of agreement. But just coming out of this with an agreement to continue talking and a willingness to dialogue, that alone means success in Singapore.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Okay, so sorry.
And I don't think I've ever said that to you, ever.
You do agree with me completely, right?
But I don't usually say that, I don't think.
Well, I wanted to get to something because there has to be some substance somewhere. And we all know we're not going to have a nuclear arms agreement coming out of one weekend in, or one day or two in Singapore. So I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. He did just agree with me. So we're on a roll here. California's primary, by the way, is in the rearview mirror. The votes are still being counted, as you may have seen the headlines, Ken. But there was a lot of anticipation about the House races. California did have a stronger than expected Republican showing. So what about the primary from last week is of interest to you and of note politically?
Well, the big headline going into the primary clearly was because of the top two system that California has. There were fears in the Democratic Party that some Democratic candidates in seats that were seen as vulnerable, held by Republicans, and there were seven of those that were won by Hillary Clinton. There were those who felt that there were so many Democratic candidates, they would cancel each other's vote out, and they'd wind up with two Republicans competing for the seat in November. That didn't happen. In the Dana Rohrabacher seat, in Steve Knight, other vulnerable Republican seats around the country, there was fear among the Democrats that they would cancel each other out, not be represented on the ballot. That didn't happen. So in that sense, that was a surprise because you know, I mean, everybody, if the Democrats are going to win control of the House in November, and I'm not convinced they are, I mean, who knows what's going to happen, but they have to start in California, given the fact that there are so many vulnerable Republicans. And the fact that the Democrats will be competing in all these seats in November is a good sign. I think another thing that surprised me was the weakness I saw with Antonio Villaraigosa.
Yeah.
I don't know if it says anything about the Latino vote, but it certainly says something about the weakness of Villaraigosa as a statewide candidate. I guess voters didn't feel that he offered, or even what he was offering, but certainly not an alternative to Gavin Newsom. So Gavin Newsom finished first as expected. Villaraigosa did not finish second as many thought. And John Cox, the Republican who was backed by President Trump via tweet, will be the Republican candidate for November. So Gavin Newsom got what he wanted. He's running against a Republican rather than running against a fellow Democrat. But Republicans got what they wanted, too, because with John Cox on the ballot in November, the Republican Party is now led by a candidate who theoretically could attract more votes to save those, as I say, those seven or eight vulnerable Republicans on the ballot in November.
Yeah, two very different candidates. I think another Villaraigosa factor was education. A lot of charter school money, big money behind him, and to what degree people will read into the fact that this was a statement about education. Definitely it's going to be a priority for whoever the next governor is in the state. And maybe that's the case in a number of states across the country, that the leadership, even though we hear a lot about economic issues, the leadership will have to focus on education. Certainly it does in California.
I think that's a good point. I think the charter school issue and the charter school funding may have backfired on Villaraigosa.
So let's look at tomorrow in Nevada. And the governor's race is getting a lot of attention, of course, with a name like Laxalt attached to one of the candidates. It's going to get a lot of attention. So tell me your thoughts about the governor's race and the rest of Nevada's politics right now.
Well, I'm old enough to remember Paul Laxalt, who was governor and senator of Nevada. He was Ronald Reagan's best friend in the Senate when Laxalt was there in the 1980s.
He's 95 years old now, Ken.
Yeah, I think he's in failing health. Believe me, he's the kind of guy I always wish I had interviewed, because he was one of those low-key guys who knew everything. And he certainly knew. He was a big behind-the-scenes guy for Reagan, starting in 1976 when Reagan challenged President Ford. So Paul Laxalt was always the kind of Republican I always found fascinating. I wish I had the opportunity to interview him. I never did. His grandson, of course, is the Attorney General of Nevada, Adam Laxalt, who, you know, the Republicans have held the seat, the governorship in Nevada, for nearly 20 years. That may be vulnerable. I know the two Democrats, the top two Democrats in tomorrow's primary, are beating each other up pretty severely.
Yeah.
A lot of it personal stuff. Steve Sisolak, I think he's accused his opponent of protecting sex perverts. I mean, that's how silly and pointed and ugly that race is getting. But again, you know, he's backed by Harry Reid. The Hillary Clinton carried the state. I'm not sure if I'm looking as much as tomorrow's primaries as I am in November, because Dean Heller still has to be one of the most vulnerable, if not the most vulnerable, Republican senator seeking re-election. The only Republican in a state won by Hillary Clinton. And you have House races, too. You know, you talk about the fact that that President Trump saved Dean Heller from a tough primary battle against Danny Tarkanian, because he pushed Tarkanian out of the Senate race into a House seat. That's a House seat we're going to be watching as well. Nevada is going to be very crucial. It only has four House seats compared to the 8 gazillion California has. Mm-hmm. But again, there are at least two or three of them that's going to be very close. The Senate race will be very close. Nevada will be one of the key states for the House and Senate in November, without question.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good Monday. All eyes will be on the developments this evening. And Ken, we look forward to talking to you next time.
And then we'll have a Ken and Beth summit next week to see if that works out.
Hey, you're invited for one of those anytime you come west, okay?
Thank you so much.
And I'll know in the first minute whether it's going well. Ken Rudin is the political junkie. We do check in with him every week for events and analysis. Here's a programming note. NPR News will begin its special coverage of the Singapore summit tonight at 6 o'clock, and the BBC coverage continues at 7 in place of Insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio.